Welcome to the Sunday night newcomer and returning members meeting of Overeaters Anonymous. Visit our website at oaontario.org, where you'll find this audio recording, additional podcasts, and a place to donate to keep this special service active. The opinions expressed are those of individual OA members and do not represent OA as a whole. We will now introduce our speaker. A member who has at least 6 months of abstinence has recovered through the directions in the Big Book and maintains recovery on a daily basis. After the share, there will be time to make a comment or ask a question about the OA program or what the speaker has shared. Please help me welcome Sheila J.
So my name is Sheila. I'm a compulsive overeater. I'm visiting you from Los Angeles, and it's good to be here. Thank you, Kimberly, for having me. It's always an honor and a privilege to share at an Overeaters Anonymous meeting. And I love Canada. I love Canada, originally from Michigan. So we spent a lot of time in Canada, and I taught up there at one of your universities. And again, I always joke and I say that, you know, when all is said and done, right, and we're across the veil, my questions for God won't be why the Holocaust, which would be a good question. Why did I grow up in my crazy alcoholic family, which would be another good question. My question will be, why couldn't I have been born like 300 miles north in Canada instead of Michigan? I love Canada. I love how you love your land. I love how you are warm and kind and love nature. And yeah, it's a great place. So good on you. I love you. And I love Overeaters Anonymous. I got to tell you. So be prepared for a half an hour of me waxing poetic about OA, because I really have plugged in a lot of the holes that I had in my life through Overeaters Anonymous. And I've been here for 33 years. I only have 21 years of abstinence. I was a slipper for a dozen years. And all that means is I just wasn't ready to feel the feelings. And I had a lot of feelings growing up in my alcoholic family. My parents weren't alcoholics, but my grandfathers were, both maternal and paternal. And alcoholism travels south quickly. And so I was definitely affected by the ism in my home. And I was in college. I was in the seventh year of my four-year undergraduate degree. And it was suggested, I was in a group therapy situation, and a couple of the facilitators, grad student facilitators, suggested maybe I wanted to go check out Al-Anon. So I did, and I was 22. And a year later, it seemed important to pay more attention to my own alcoholism and not worry about the people drinking in my family. So I went to AA, got a sponsor, started working the steps. And 3 months in, I turned to somebody and I said, "You think you can have a problem with sugar, like you have a problem with alcohol?" And she said, "Absolutely, go to Overeaters Anonymous." And I weighed 200 pounds at the time. Then now I'm 23 years old and was just in a lot of pain. I had a lot more bad things happen to me in my life behind sugar and quantity eating than ever happened to me behind my drinking and drugging. And sugar was always my drug of choice. Still is, right? If you were to line up a bottle of tequila, a joint, a line of cocaine, a carton of Marlboro Greens, and a hot fudge sundae, I'd run to the hot fudge sundae. I still would, like hands down. No contest at all. And so at any rate, it was suggested that I go check out Overeaters Anonymous. I didn't know what that was about. I didn't know how this worked. I knew an AA didn't drink, so I showed up at this 11 a.m. AA meeting on a Saturday morning, Sparrow Hospital in Lansing, Michigan. And I hadn't eaten because, again, what are we doing here? Not sure. And it was a great meeting. I remember it was led by a beautiful African-American woman who had just completed her doctorate in accounting, which was so impressive to me, again, because of my struggle with a four-year undergraduate degree. And she was at a healthy body weight, warm, engaging. And I'd heard through the course of this meeting, I heard people talking about abstinence. I didn't know what that was. So afterwards, this woman stayed and talked with me. And she said, is there a problem food that you have? Is there something you eat that's a problem for you? And I said, oh yeah, no, sugar is horrible for me. I mean, I'm a hellacious sugar eater. I have a filling in just about every molar in my mouth. She said, yeah, a lot of us have a problem with sugar. She said, do you think it would be possible for you to not eat sugar today and eat just three meals? Do you think that would be possible? Now, I'm hoping the conversation went beyond that, because we wouldn't ever want to send a newcomer out the door with, oh, sugar's a problem for you. Just don't eat sugar. Have three meals. See you next week. Bye. We would never want to do that. But even if, and I'm going to give her the benefit of the doubt anyway, because I just think she had too much going on to have stopped the conversation there. But even if she did, the responsibility would have been mine, because I knew how 12-step programs worked at that point. Remember, at this point in the game, this is February of 1988, I'd started in program in 86. So I already had, at this point, I already had 15, 16 months of program, right? I had 3-4 months in Alcoholics Anonymous with a sponsor working the steps. And again, I'd been in Al-Anon for a year. I didn't get a sponsor in Al-Anon right away. It took me years to get an Al-Anon sponsor. But again, the point is, I knew the drill. I knew how this worked. I knew that if I came to meetings, I was going to feel better. And if I got a sponsor and started working steps, I was going to get better. So there's no mystery there. But I left that meeting and again, I hadn't eaten. So now I'm hungry. It's close to 1 o'clock. So I go to a restaurant and I order a meal and they put it down in front of me. And I think, I eat the meal. I go back out and sit in my car and I think, huh, three meals a day. No sugar. It's got to be more complicated than that. And for the next dozen years, I proceeded to complicate it. And all that means is, because I thought at the time that that was some kind of a moral issue, that I'd done that. But all it means is I wasn't ready to feel the feelings. I just wasn't ready to feel the feelings. And I had a lot of feelings that were coming up based on the alcoholic home I grew up in. There's a lot of bad stuff that went on in my home. And my parents were both very affected by their fathers. And my mother in particular was very challenged by her alcoholic father. He was horrendously violent. He wasn't even just a child beater. He was a beater upper. And my mother was a wounded bird for a lifetime. She never got past that. And I'll see if I can't get that dog quieted down. Hey. But she never got past it. She was just troubled for a lifetime. And I was the youngest of five kids, probably an unplanned pregnancy. My siblings were all much closer in age. And we were kind of lower middle class. My dad had gone to school on the GI Bill down here and was building a very successful business. He had to bring that tumbling down on his head, though, because he just couldn't sit with that life of ease and grace, because that's how he was affected by alcoholism. Because alcoholism or compulsive eating, right? It doesn't have anything to do with the substance. This doesn't have anything to do with tortilla chips or white flour or what number of ingredients, sugar. It doesn't have anything to do with that. My sponsor, Nanette, always says for her, this is a disease of perfectionism. This is about dealing with perfectionism. That's the pathology we're really looking at. I hear her on that, and that makes sense. Part of me agrees with that, but the larger experience for me is this is a disease about communication and using my voice and using my words. That's what it is for me. But it certainly doesn't have anything. I never had a problem with food, even when I had a problem with food. I didn't have a weight problem, even when I had a weight problem. It's always been a heart issue. It's always been a heart issue. I don't love easily and I don't forgive easily. Those are my issues, and it's gotten much better over time as I've been here. And I'm going to talk about that, but I haven't gotten it yet. I'm getting it, but I haven't gotten it, right? This will be a lifetime journey for me. So it really makes sense to me what the direction is that we got from our founders and from Carl Jung and from William Silkworth and Harry Thiebaud, all those people who said, you're going to be in here for life. That really makes sense to me because the grooves really run deep. There are old, old patterns here. And food isn't the problem. Food is the solution. But when I take away the solution, the problems show up, hence the necessity for step work. And so I left that meeting and had that meal and got a sponsor though. I never saw that woman again. So she probably completed her education and left town. But I got a sponsor within a couple of weeks and started working the steps at sponsor's direction. I just do what people ask me to do. I don't argue with sponsors or cops. So I just do what people ask me to do. And it became clear within a couple of weeks' time that I wasn't ready to stop eating sugar and I wasn't ready to stop quantity eating. I wasn't ready to feel the feelings. And my sponsor, this brilliant, brilliant woman, in her infinite wisdom, because this was 3 years before the conference approved Overeaters Anonymous OA 12 and 12 came out, where it's corroborated in that literature, she said to me, "Let's not worry about the food. That's a God job. Let's just have you keep your focus on doing the step work." Now, this didn't make a lot of sense to me because, again, I knew what was going on in the mother program for me, right? I wasn't drinking tequila anymore and I was working the steps. But again, I don't debate with people here. I don't argue with people who know more than me. There's a lot of challenges I've had in my life, but I got to tell you, I don't argue with people who are in front of me on the path, on any path, any given path. So I just said, okay, all right. And the other thing, the other bullet that I dodged here, I was really lucky. I knew that I was never going to be lying about my food. I just knew if I was going to lie about something, I was going to lie about something more interesting than my food. I'm going to tell you I'm Julia Roberts' cousin, or I used to date Brad Pitt, or I went to Harvard Medical School, but I prefer to work at the Gap, right? Whatever it is. I'm going to lie about something more interesting than my food. I'm not going to lie about my food. So, so my sponsor was, you know, giving me direction, step direction, and I was just following it. Okay. So, and again, my top weight's 200 pounds. I don't have a scale at my house, but I was just at the gym today. And I usually weigh myself when I'm there. And interestingly enough, I don't know why I lost weight during the pandemic. So normally I hang out around 135 is usually about what I weigh. I'm 5'7" and 57 years old. But now I'm down to 128. I'm not quite sure what that's about. I know I'm going to probably have to show up at my dietitian's office and find out what's going on. So, at any rate, I got going working the steps. And my dad had three overweight daughters. As I said, I'm the youngest of five. And, all three daughters were overweight and he didn't like it. And he was very vocal about it. And he'd make public comments. But my oldest sister, he'd throw a baseball at her. She'd throw three back. So he wasn't going to give her too much grief. And my middle sister worked in my dad's business. So he wasn't going to give her too much trouble. So I was an easy target. And there's a lot of shame that shows up when somebody is publicly, particularly the man who should be communicating to you loud and clear that all little girls are beautiful princesses, as all little boys are handsome princes on steeds, right? That's the message that we all should have gotten. And I suspect perhaps I'm not the only one who didn't get that message, but all I know is I didn't get that message. And that's devastating. I mean, it's just, it's real trouble. And it creates a situation where there's real shame. And additionally, the problem for me is that I was also molested when I was a kid by two different men on numerous occasions, when I was five, when I was 10. The more egregious came when I was 10. So I already had issues of shame going on. And being from an alcoholic family where it was very, very unsafe, there was a lot of bad stuff that happened in my home. And a lot of violence and raging and we got belted real good. The worst is that people didn't know how to talk to each other, which is why I think this is a disease. These are diseases about communication and using your words and connecting. When we ended up in pain, there was never that ability to reconnect. When human beings are always going to have conflict, there's always going to be some breakdown in communication. So if there's a problem at the wedding and I don't know how to say, hey, Joanna, can we talk about what happened at the wedding? Because you said this, I heard this. Is this what you meant? Is that what you meant? If we don't know how to do that, what happens is stuff is going to start stacking up year after year. And relationships will get fractured, as they have in my family. And all of a sudden, you're having an argument in 2018 and you're referencing something from 1993. That's alcoholism. That's the eating disorder. That's the pathology that we're talking about here. So it has many different faces. The way that the idea that I ended up overweight is that's the caboose of the train. That is the caboose of the train in terms of the eating disorder. There are so many other things that created real problems for me in terms of my inability to connect with people and be connected. And it certainly didn't help that I was molested. And it certainly didn't help that it didn't feel safe to talk to anybody. I never told a soul until I got in 12-step programs. And I told a therapist. I never told anybody. And that's interesting to me that I already knew at 5 years old, when this was happening on numerous occasions, my mother would take me to the grocery store, and this was when grocery stores were, you know, 3-4 times the size of a convenience store. And this guy would be giving me inappropriate French kisses in the front of the store in exchange for candy bars. And my mother was never around. I have no idea where my mother was, but I don't know why there weren't any other customers around. There was one cash register in the store that was across from the candy counter. That's where he was. That's where all this manhandling was going on. And it never occurred to me. At 5 years old, I already knew when my mother was driving me home, I knew it was not the thing to do to say anything to her about this. That's alcoholism. That's the pathology. That's what we're talking about. I already knew that. And then when the more egregious stuff happened at 10 years old, I just dove deeper. So I was a troubled little girl from the get-go. I cut all my eyelashes off when I was in the first grade. I had UTIs when I was 5 and 6 years old. That was when they started. I was peeing 3, 4, 5 times a night. As I said, by the time I got to junior high, I had a filling just about every molar in my mouth. None of these things were getting anybody's attention. Nothing. And nobody else in my family had the kind of dental issues that I did. Nothing was getting anybody's attention. That's the pathology. That's what we're talking about. That's the problem. So see, the food, and I came out of the chute, right, with a propensity to abuse sugar and with the allergy to sugar. So I've got a sister who's allergic to cats. You put her in a room with a cat, doesn't matter if it's a tabby, a Siamese, a long hair, a short hair, she's going to start schnodding and snorting. That's the same thing with me with sugar. So something is different for me when I take sugar in. I'm very, very clear about that. But that's not the problem. The problem is, why do I reach for the sugar when it was causing me so many problems right from the beginning? Why do I consistently go to something, you know, you stub your toe and it hurts like hell. So I take a hammer and I hit my thumb to distract myself from the stubbed toe. That's the pathology. That's the pain. That's what we're talking about here. And I did it for a lifetime. I just did it and could not stop. So when I encounter this sponsor who says, we're just going to work the steps and we're going to let God take care of the food. That's a God job, right? Because we read in A, B, and C at the end of how it works, right? On page 60. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. C, that God couldn't would if he were sought. But that B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. That's a really important one. That's a really important one to stay conscious about. And my sponsor, thank God, was very clear about that. So I just was going to follow direction. So I did. And my whole 12-step journey, as I mentioned, I'm from Michigan. So we were largely influenced by the Alcoholics Anonymous and Bob Smith from Ohio, Dr. Bob. And Bob's philosophy is that you go through the steps over and over and over again. You're going to be doing this for a lifetime. In contrast to the New York cohort, right, Bill and all his people, who just had this idea that you're going to work steps 1 through 9, and then you're going to work 10, 11, and 12 for the rest of your life. And Bill, for a long time, thought you only needed to do 1 4-step in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he reversed himself, and he talks about that in AA Comes of Age. I came from Michigan, and I knew I was just going to be going through the steps over and over again. And it was already happening in the mother program for me. So that was really useful for me because it took the pressure off. I never ended up in a situation. I mean, first of all, I never ended up in a situation where I was doing a 4-step where it was stressful anyway. I've always loved doing 4-steps. Felt very comfortable and very healing to me. And I was, you know, somebody who was keeping diaries and journals from when I was very young, and I'm a writer. So, I mean, I have no problem with writing stuff down. And even knowing that I was going to be sharing it on a 5th step, I just never had any issues with that. But also this idea that I was going to be going through the steps over and over again took the pressure off. I wasn't going to need to land anything perfectly in terms of a 4-step. All I needed to do was get it done, right? The only way you do a 4-step wrong is by not doing a 4-step. So I get going in 1988 with this sponsor and working the steps, and 2 years in, so now it's 1990, and I've lost 20 pounds. So something has happened. I don't know what has happened, but something has happened because I now weigh 180. And, you know, my top weight's 200 pounds, and I haven't weighed 200 pounds since February of 1988. So I'm at a family event, now 26 years old. I'm at a family event. Somewhere there's a picture of me. I can see what I'm wearing. And I walk by my dad. There's, you know, half dozen people around on the front porch. And he said, "Well, I can see you've lost some weight, but you've got a lot more to go. Don't let up." And I turned around and I said, "No more. That's it. It's over. You do not talk to me about my weight anymore. It's over." And everybody was kind of looking like, "Oh my God, what's..." Because nobody talked to my dad like that. Now, I wasn't trying to be disrespectful, but I was really just meeting fire with glorious fire. It was never appropriate for my dad to talk to me about my body weight. That actually qualifies as sexual pathology. I mean, it's DSM-5 or 6, whatever version they're in now. I used to work for a psychiatrist. I mean, it was never appropriate for him to do that. It wasn't ever okay. And nobody can tell me that that wasn't recovery. Now, it was going to be another 10 years before I was going to get abstinent. But that was a direct result of 2 years of working the steps in Overeaters Anonymous with a sponsor. Despite the fact, as far as I was concerned, nothing had changed with my eating. I didn't know what happened. I didn't know how I lost 20 pounds then. In the same way, I don't know how I lost 7 pounds over the last, you know, however many months. I don't know. I don't know how this, I don't really know. So I just know that I got to finally stand up to the bully and communicate that the game was up, that we weren't gonna continue on this, down this road. This just wasn't gonna happen anymore. And my dad never spoke to me about my weight. He took responsibility and gave me a sincere, powerful apology and amends, right? It's not, you know, the amends isn't the apology. The amends is the changed behavior. So he apologized and he changed his behavior and never spoke to me about my weight again, never was unkind to me about my weight ever again. And that was amazing for me. That was an amazing experience. So I keep plugging along and working the steps. And I ended up in California because I came to in need to get into an eating disorder unit, because even though my weight didn't go back up, I was in a lot of distress with all the sugar eating and all the real craziness in my family was starting to become very, very clear. And so I came to California and ended up staying here, and always was going to meetings and always had a sponsor and was always working the steps. But what my journey was about during those years is I would lose and gain. I would lose and gain. So again, never got back up to 200 again, but I would bounce. I would go up and down 10, 15 pounds. And I'd do that 3-4 times a year. So if you lose and gain 15, 20 pounds, 3-4 times a year, that's, you know, that's 120 to 150, you know, 140, 60 pounds a year, right? Depending on how often you do it, et cetera, and what the numbers are. And I had a registered dietitian because I ended up with a pretty serious health diagnosis. And my doctor sent me to a registered dietitian. He said, I don't know anything about food. I know it has something to do with this health, right? And if you want to get better, you're going to have to take a look at your food, but I don't know anything about food. Doctors don't. He said, go to an RD. So I went to this woman who was also a member of Overeaters Anonymous. And one of the things she had me do over time, over the couple of years I saw her professionally, she's still in my life. I don't see her professionally, but we're good friends. This was, 30 years ago. But one of the things she had me track at one point was how my weight gains and weight losses. So I went on my first diet when I was in the ninth grade, and I was thinking about dieting when I was in elementary school. And if you were to give me a month and a year, okay, something's up on the screen. Anyway, I'm not going to pay any attention to that, but something has shifted where you guys have all gone away. Okay. If you were to give me a month and a year, I can tell you within 5 pounds what I weigh. And my husband said to me once, he said, I don't know what's crazier, the idea that you can do that or that you did that. But I can't, right? So she had me track these weight losses and weight gains. And despite the fact I'm not a 100-pounder and haven't weighed 200 pounds since 88, I have lost and gained, I mean, it's more fun when I know the exact number, but I've lost and gained over 1,650 pounds, close to 1,700 pounds. And that's just losing and gaining, losing and gaining, losing and gaining. Because that was my thing, right? Because again, it was this running to stand still. That was how the distress was getting handled in my life, is by not being consistent. There's a few ways to keep people at arm's length. The way that I've always done it is by being inconsistent, because that was my, the issues with my heart translate to issues with intimacy. And the way I have kept people at arm's length, used to do it a lot more in my life, and sometimes this gremlin can still show up, is just being inconsistent. Because then it just keeps people on their toes. They never kind of know, where you're going to be coming from. And it's no way to live. But I'm grateful I don't have to live that way anymore. So I was just doing this losing and gaining routine year after year after year. And then now my husband is going to be coming in the room. So I'm going to move to another space here. So I'm going to just keep talking. So till we get him out of here. So now we're coming up on, it's 2000. And I've been here since 88. And at this time, I weigh now about 100 and I would say about 155, probably 155 pounds. So something has definitely come together for me through this period of time. And at that time, I probably had done, 10 fourth steps in Overeaters Anonymous, in addition to the step work I was doing in the mother program and stuff. So, I mean, it was something interesting was happening, because I had that pretty significant weight loss. I mean, I'm 45 pounds down and I'm still not abstinent in my mind. And my sponsor and that registered dietitian, who was also a member of Overeaters Anonymous, as I said, independent of each other in the week, said, okay, so I was trying to start my video. Now it's saying I can't start it because the host has stopped it. So, yeah. So at any rate, okay, so I can't go live. Okay, hang on, just a little phone here. So independently of each other, these two women said, You got to have an abstinence state. This is crazy, right? You've lost a lot of weight here. Something has shifted. You've done the step work. You're on board with all of that. Just so you know, whoever's hosting, I can't go live. I can't.
5 minutes, Sheila.
Sure, thanks. So they said you got to claim an abstinence state, and since they were both saying it. And they both agreed, and it was independent of each other. I just followed direction, and so my sponsor picked my date for me. So she picked May 30th of 2000, right? Because we were at the end of May.
Sheila, you should be able to turn your video on now.
Okay. So she said, let's just choose May 30th. So that was my absence date. And what was clear though, you know, within a couple of months is I still wasn't done eating sugar. My sponsor said, that's all right. You know, there are people in Overeaters Anonymous who still eat sugar, not binging. You're being honest with your food. And so I just followed direction. I certainly wasn't eating sugar the way I used to eat it before. And I just followed direction. And within a couple of years, the compulsion to eat sugar went away. And what happened, as I'll close out with this little story, is so it was January of, it was like 3.5 years. So it was January of 2004. And my husband and I were going out to dinner. And my pattern with sugar was always kind of on again, off again, on again, off again. Especially as my weight was getting lower and lower. Because, I mean, I might eat, you know, a single item of sugar, a bowl of ice cream or something. I wasn't binging the way I was when I was much heavier. But I was still eating sugar. But I would go on and off, on and off. That was kind of my pattern. And I had in November, the beginning of November 2003, I went into another one of the routines where I wasn't going to be eating sugar again. So my birthday's at the end of October, and nobody in their right mind goes off sugar before Halloween. So I think it was like November 7th, I stopped eating sugar. And I made it through the holidays, right? Made it through the new year, made it through January. So now I'm like 6-7 weeks out. And I'm on one of those runs where I'm not eating sugar. 3.5 years absent, no way. Probably weigh maybe 145. And my husband and I go out to dinner. We're at this, you know, la-di-da restaurant. We're there late. We're eating late. And I don't know what happened at the meal. I don't know. I don't know if the waiter looked at me cross-eyed. I know there was a couple in the corner who were kind of making out in the corner. I don't know where I got triggered. And I just know that all of a sudden, I haven't had sugar for 7 weeks, and I decide, we're done with dinner. And I said to my husband, let's get a dessert and share it. And my husband, he wasn't my husband at the time. He was my fiance, but he like grips the table, like, okay. Cause he knows the ride we're about to go on. And so the waiter brings it, we order a dessert, the waiter brings it. And I'm pretending I'm one of those Hollywood type girlfriends who can share a dessert with my husband. You know, we both got forks and we're going to share, but that's not me. And I know it's not me because my guy is eating twice as much as I am, twice as many bites as I am. And I know because I'm counting. I'm counting my bites and his bites, which is not easy to do. And now I've awoken the giant. I have. It's the allergy of the body and the obsession of the mind that Silkworth talks about. The obsession of the mind never goes away. But now I've woken up the allergy of the body. So now I got to get out of here because I haven't had sugar for 7 weeks. So all the feelings that have been going on, remember, food's not the problem, it's the solution. And when I take away the solution, the problems come up. So the problems now, it's everything that I had been dodging is now exploding out because I've been handling it with step work. But now it's just all over the, and we got to get out of here. I got to get sugar. I got to get it immediately, right? We got to get out of here. Waiter, check, right? I got to get out of this restaurant and I need to get real deal sugar because my husband's got sugar at home, but my husband eats like dark chocolate and stuff. And I can't eat sugar unless it's got fat. I would never eat a jelly bean unless I can deep fry it. So there's nothing at my house for me to eat. And I have woken up the sugar giant and I need real deal sugar. And my husband never wants to valet park. He always wants to park, you know, 5 blocks from the restaurant. So, you know, we're out there, it's like 12:30 at night. And I'm like, come on, baby, let's go. Right. I got to get to the car. I'm already planning the lie. I got the lie going on. This is going to be easy. He's going to be putty in my hands. I know how to lie to him. And what's ironic, because this is the pathology. I don't know why I felt like I needed to lie to him. My husband, he'd been watching me do this for years. I don't know why I didn't just say, okay, I'm back in the sugar. I need to stop at the market on the way home. But no, instead I'm planning the lie. And when my hand touches the handle of our car, all of a sudden I thought, wow, I'm glad I don't live in a high rise. I thought, wow, where did that come from? And in that moment, I got powerlessness. 3.5 years abstinent, no Overeaters Anonymous, copious number of times through the steps. And I finally got powerlessness over sugar. because I got it that I was glad I didn't live in a high rise, because I could no longer guarantee if I kept eating sugar that I wasn't going to one day kill myself. I finally got it. And went home that night and didn't end up having sugar, even though I had a really good lie plan for how to get it, but there's not time for the story. But I woke up the next day, and what did I do? I had sugar again. It was Wednesday, January 14th, 2004, and I had sugar again, even though I'd had this awareness the night before that I might take myself out. That's the pathology. That's the disease. That's how serious this is. And then for whatever reason, on January 15th, the next day, because I had it on the 14th, I woke up and it had disappeared. That compulsion to eat sugar was gone. And I picked up from there and just kept going with my abstinence. And that's what happened for me here in Overeaters Anonymous. And I have continued to work the steps. I sponsor a lot of people. I lead workshops and retreats and things like that. And I'm really glad that Overeaters Anonymous brought out that book. I don't know if I've got it handy here, but here it is. You know, this is a great book, this Body Image, Relationships, and Sexuality, right? This was a really, my story is one of the stories in there. I was really glad that Overeaters Anonymous opened the door. I mean, I wish the book was longer, but I'm glad that they opened the door and started talking about the sexual trauma, because I've seen statistics that say anywhere from 40 to 70% of people dealing with eating disorders have experienced some sort of sexual trauma, some worse than others. But I'm just glad that we're talking about it, because for me, they were inextricably linked, and it was all about shame. And the shame about body weight and the size of my body became very, very closely correlated with sexuality for me. And so I'm very, very grateful to be here. And I love Overeaters Anonymous. I love the Big Book. I sponsor exclusively from the Big Book, not because I don't appreciate other confidence-proof literature. I love the OA literature. I haven't read it all. Done that OA workbook, you know, 3-4 times. And I'll, you know, whatever my sponsor wants to do, she or he is running the show. But I'm just very, very grateful to all of you, and really glad to be here. And I'll put my information in the chat. I put some other information from our Los Angeles Intergroup website. We have 57 meetings a week, and we are still on Zoom down here. So feel free to join us if you're so inclined. And my name is Sheila. I'm a compulsive eater here from Los Angeles, and it's been an honor and a privilege. So thank you for having me.
Thanks, Sheila. I really appreciate your story.